good tape recorder and
it picks up things well. How do you pronounce your last name, just so I always pronounce it correctly?
Cleaver.
Cleaver, great.
As in the beaver? Beaver Cleaver?
And you served with IVS for 3 years in Vietnam. And what years were those?
I went there in 66, and I left IVS in 69, but I stayed there till 71. Stayed in Vietnam.
Well, we're going to pick that up as we go along. There are just some preliminary questions we always ask. What year were you born?
1942.
And in?
In Kansas.
In Kansas.
In a home.
In a home. You were born in the home.
I was born
at
home.
In the home. And where in Kansas?
Ulysses, Kansas.
Which is near?
It's 100 miles straight west of Dodge City, Kansas.
Okay. So near a great railhead of the American past. What was your family like?
Well, we had a large family. Okay. There were 6 children in the family. My oldest sister left home, when I was still young, to go to school. And then later on to get married. But we were a close family. We grew up not in a, I would say, financially needy family. My father was a dirt farmer. And we went through some very dry years when there wasn't any money. So, we all wore hand-me-down clothes. Got one pair of shoes a year. The new pair was for going to church, and the old pair was for every day. Grew up on a farm a long ways from, the nearest neighbors. In fact, in grade school, went to a country school. The last 4 years of elementary school, I was the only one in my class. So when I got to high school, it was kind of a shock to find that there were kids my own age. So when I got to high school, I was a very outgoing person, but when I got to high school, because I'd been by myself so much, I was very shy. And that's pretty much my childhood, just growing up on a farm with brothers and sisters and a few cousins, and most of our activities were centered around the church. Mm-hmm. And the church and school. My mom used to say, when are we ever going to have a night for the family at home? Because we seemed like every night we were going to something.
And now there are all these entertainments that are available, and people just sit at home and never go out.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's true. The did you go to college after high school?
Yes, I went to college. Went to Tabor College, which is a Mennonite Brethren school located in central Kansas in Hillsboro, which is about 60 miles north of Wichita. I graduated in 64 and then went to Wichita State University for a year and a half to pick up a teaching degree in elementary education.
You always knew you were going into education? Was that?
No, that was, I come from a church that it's called a peace church, mm-hmm. that do not believe in active military service, taking up the gun. Our stand is not pacifism, it's non-resistance. So I wanted to go into some form of, back in those days, everybody got drafted. You served whether you wanted to or not. So I wanted to get into some kind of a service. Rather than being placed in something I wouldn't like, I wanted to do the type of service that I would enjoy, mm-hmm. and that I could find acceptable. And one deal was to work in an orphanage in Italy. But that deal fell through, and one of my college professors, who was an advisor of mine, suggested that he knew an organization called International Voluntary Service, which did the kind of stuff that I was interested in and put me in contact with him. So I talked to them. And they said, yeah, they really weren't looking for people at the time, but most likely it would be involved in something in education. So I figured, well, I'll go back to school, because this was in my senior year when this deal that I had worked out and was planning for mm-hmm. a whole year mm-hmm. fell through. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of left hanging. So I went back to school, got a education degree, called IVS back, say, well, called them back and said, well, now I have a teaching degree. And they said, great, we're looking for 200 teachers to teach English in Vietnam. And so they sent Willie Myers to Kansas City, where I was teaching in an elementary school. And he interviewed me, and I was accepted with IVS.
You weren't married then or had other family connections?
I was single, living on my own, out on my first job on mm-hmm. my own, you know, after school. You know, it wasn't just a summer job like I'd had some previously. But I was actually teaching in an elementary school. When I went to Kansas City, I had a choice. I could work a split shift at two schools in a blue-collar neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, or I could take an all-black school in a government-created ghetto. Now, in Kansas City, they had built these housing mm-hmm. areas. And they put all their welfare cases and all the poor people in these housings, and it created a ghetto. Mm-hmm. It was so bad that the police wouldn't go in there at night. And I was supposed to go in there in the daytime and teach. But I figured that was the greater challenge. And what I found was generally the children were 2 years behind their counterparts in other areas. I had a tremendous discipline problem. I had the principal, he worked with me and worked with me and says, you've got to do better. Every week I had to come up with a new idea. It worked great on Monday, still worked on Tuesday and Wednesday. By Thursday it was falling through, and by Friday I'd lost complete control of the class. They sent a specialist there, a black lady, who was going to show me how to teach. So she came there. The first day, the kids were angels. The second and third day, they were terrific. On Thursday, they started to get out of control. By Friday, they knew her, and they went wild. And after she had been there for a week, she says, Mr. Cleaver, it's not you. I said, I knew that. And my last day of school, I went and I talked to the principal and went to say my goodbyes. And he says, Mr. Cleaver, he says, now you know what it's like. Now you know what we're up against. And I would have liked to have stayed there for another year, because I taught in the sixth grade. The fifth graders looked up to me. And they couldn't wait to get me as their teacher, because I had done so much. They saw that I had done so much with those sixth graders, teaching them tumbling and gymnastics. And I practically threw away all the textbooks and made my own to teach math, to try to get them back up to speed where they were supposed to be, and worked with their reading and reading skills. And a lot of them were really looking forward to it, and they came up to me and said, we're so sorry to see you're leaving. But by that time, I was committed to go to Vietnam, and I was sort of looking down the barrel of the gun to be drafted anyway, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, what was your reaction when they said, oh, we need 200 teachers to go to Vietnam?
Well, at that time, Vietnam was not so terribly much in the news. We had advisors there, and there was stuff going on there. And I had originally been told that I would probably be sent to Laos to work building schools, mm-hmm. which was one of the reasons why I went to get a teaching degree. I thought, well, if I'm going to be working around schools, why not get a teaching degree mm-hmm. also? And when I called them back up, and they said, yeah, we need 200 teachers I was looking forward to it, and a lot of people says, you know, there's a war going on there, and at that time it wasn't in the news, although some service, you know, it had gone from sending advisors there to actually sending troops there. And so my attitude towards the whole thing was, well, we'll see when we get there what it's like, whether we should be there or whether we shouldn't be there.
So you went out of a position of a kind of, you know, you're going to do some service somewhere. You know that education is some place where you can make a contribution. They want you to go to Vietnam. You're willing to go have a look-see.
Yeah. And my mother had a funny comment. As a child, whenever she'd fix rice, I hated it. I did not like rice. I'd eat anything but rice, and I had to be almost disciplined to be made to eat rice. And our way of eating rice was to put sugar and cinnamon and milk in it, kind of like eating a cereal. And she laughed. She says, you're going to Vietnam, you're going to have to learn to like rice. But when I got there, I found out that they fixed their rice different, and I did like it.
There's a parallel project I have just as a learning project for my students. I have them interview people who served in Vietnam, hopefully their own parents, because a lot of times their parents are service folk,
mm-hmm.
and they never talk about it with their own kids. And I always ask them a question, what did your family think when they heard you were going to Vietnam? Did they have an awareness of Vietnam? Other than just the comment on the rice, which is priceless, actually. Did they say, are you sure you want to do this? Or did they say, well, I guess you've made up your mind? What was their... It's a big family. How did they think about it?
I grew up in a family that was very, democratically run. In that we were taught the way to go and the way that was right. And then it was up to us. And my mother didn't like it that I was going to Vietnam. But, you know, the day I left to go to Washington, D.C. for the training was on her birthday. And as they were driving me to Liberal, Kansas to catch a DC-3, which was the first commercial flight that I'd ever been on, she said, you sure are giving me some birthday present. But they respected what I was doing. And, they really didn't discourage me, but my father never really said much. But, you know, my mother let me know that it wasn't what her choice would have been. But there was never a statement made like, you can't do this, why are you doing this? It was my own decision, and they respected that.
Do you have how many brothers did you have?
Three brothers.
Three. And what did they end up doing for their during that era?
Okay, my oldest brother did his service teaching school in Newfoundland, mm-hmm. and that was in a remote area. He said that it's about 300 years behind our time. It was his description. My next oldest brother was married at the time. He got married right out of college. And he went and did his service in South Texas on the border. Taught science in a mission school and worked with a church in a little border town. My youngest brother, of course, he did his service while I was gone, so I really don't know much about that, except that he did something in Omaha, Nebraska. But they all did something of their own choosing rather than letting it being dictated to them.
So you the next step was always going to Washington, D.C. for the orientation program.
Right.
And what was that like?
Well, you know, I went there not knowing what to expect. And they worked with us. You know, we went through the orientation period. We went out to, what was the name of the little town in... in Virginia, famous for John Brown, Harper's Ferry,
mm-hmm.
Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, and had our orientation there, and we listened to people who had been to Vietnam tell their stories, and they told us about the culture there, do's and don'ts, and how to assimilate ourselves in the culture, which in our type of work was very, very important. And, you know, we got some idea of what we were going to be involved in, but no idea. It really wasn't. And then we went through language. When I say language training, I'm speaking of how to teach a language rather than learning a language. Mm-hmm. At the Institute of Modern Languages. There in Washington, D.C., spent about 3 weeks, if I remember right, actually, you know, observing, learning how, and then actually teaching with international students to learn what is the oral method. It sounds the same, but oral being to hear and oral being to speak. Mm-hmm. You listen and then you speak. And we learned that method. We learned phonetics. And about the amount of time we spent in those 3 weeks would have been equivalent of about 8 hours of college coursework. Yeah, coursework. So you know, we were trained to do what we went to do, and so you know. We had some idea of what we were getting into.
Did you leave directly after the training? Did you leave for Vietnam?
Yes. I remember that time because we were supposed to make a stop in Japan for several days. We were all looking forward to that. And then there was that airline strike, where all the air carriers struck. And so we were delayed by several days, which cut our time. We were going to spend a couple of days in Japan. Now we weren't going to spend any time in Japan. Other arrangements had to be made with a foreign carrier. Instead of leaving from Washington, D.C., we had to be bused to New York, and that was a trip. The bus driver thought we were supposed to be there at 3 o'clock, and the plane left at 3 o'clock. So we just barely made it. And we had a block of seats. Well, they had given away those seats, and they managed to find other seats. So instead of being all together, we were scattered through the plane. And then we went to Hawaii. But we had a mechanical in San Francisco, so that cut down on our time that we were supposed to spend in Hawaii. We were supposed to get there in the evening and then leave at noon the next day, so we'd have the morning in Hawaii. So we didn't get into Honolulu until 4 o'clock in the morning, but I still got up early and, and swam in Waikiki Beach,
yes,
where I was out there swimming. And I must have been about a quarter mile from the beach, having the time of my life out there swimming in the ocean. And all of a sudden, my foot hit the bottom and I slashed open the top of my foot on coral. I stopped and I stood up and I was waist deep. I walked back to the shore. I thought I was out in the ocean. And then we did go to Hong Kong, although our luggage was all left in Honolulu. So we spent 2 days in Hong Kong, 1 day without any luggage or anything, because it didn't get there till the next day. And we got to spend 2 days in Hong Kong, and we did get to get into the Asian culture. And it was my first attempt at trying to eat with chopsticks. And I thought I did quite well. I managed to get the food from the plate to my mouth. And of course, the people in the restaurant were watching us and snickering. The waiters, and pretty obvious that we were doing this for the first time. But then I remember our first sight of Vietnam as we came into the country over flying over it, and we were all looking out the windows.
How did you come into Vietnam? Did you fly from?
From Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
From Hong Kong into Saigon. And I would imagine, now on the trip that I just went there, we flew in at Vung Tau. But I think, if I remember right, we hit Vietnam in about Nha Trang, mm-hmm. or up in that area, as we were coming in and flying in.
And so you landed in Saigon.
We landed in Saigon.
And what was your first impression was as you rolled along the runway? Did you see anything? Did you think anything?
Well, I was, you know, I was just there, and it was the same thing. Saw a lot of military planes. So you knew you were in a war zone. There was a lot of security. And, you know, it was all so new, and the hot, humid air.
When did you arrive? What month?
It was in July.
July.
So
this is July of 66.
July of 66. So, you know, trying to, it's so long ago, that's been 30 years ago.
No, but almost everyone remembers the heat and the humidity when the door opens. That's kind of sticks with
not, you. Not that we didn't have heat and humidity in Hong Kong because we did.
Right.
But it was, and if I remember right, also, there was a smell. Kind of I don't want to say a rotten smell, but you know, when vegetation is decomposing, that kind of a smell was around.
So when you arrived in Saigon, you were met by IVS personnel who did what with you?
Met by Don Luce. They loaded us up in their, they had those Jeep station wagons, mm-hmm. and they loaded us up in the Jeep station wagons and took us to the IVS house. And you know, we were all wide-eyed looking at all this, you know, as we were driving from Tansanit to the IVS house. I remember walking from the IVS house to Tansanit, and in some ways it seemed like it was very near, and some ways it seemed like it was a long ways. Now, when I was just there, I walked from my hotel, which was at the Tansanit gate, mm-hmm. to the IVS house, and it wasn't that far. It was actually very close, mm-hmm. you know, a few city blocks.
But it seemed like a lot longer then?
Yeah. And it may just be, even though we walked that a lot. When I got off at the airport, rather than taking a taxi, which would overcharge me, and we didn't have that much money, I'd walk. You know, I'd have my shoulder bag, and I'd walk to the IVS house.
So now you find yourself at the IVS house. How many people were there when you were there, when you arrived?
Well, we had a pretty good good-sized group with us. It may have been something like 15 or 20 people. And we got unloaded and grabbed bunk beds. And, you know, the girls over on their side and us on our, men on their side. And they took us out for our first meal was for beef served seven ways. That was our first introduction to the Vietnamese cuisine. And, of course, we were all ready to try new things. So we found out seven ways to fix beef. And it was, I was impressed. It was quite good.
Mm-hmm. And you were then assigned to other places. How did that...
we went through a little orientation period there in Saigon. And then we went to... the teachers were assigned to do language study I want to say Long Xuyên, but that wasn't Long Xuyên. That was now I can't remember the name of the town.
How far was it from the IVS house?
Well, this was down in the Delta.
Okay.
You know, we took a plane to go from Saigon to and I should remember this because
it'll come back to you. But also, other people who went to the Delta will remember the name of the town. So.
Yeah.
So you went to there was a kind of a school set up to train IVS educators. Or?
Yeah. We stayed in one of the volunteers who worked there, Fred Lynn, who was stationed there. They had a house, and they set up a bunch of bunk beds. It was a three-story house, so there was plenty of room. And we did our language study at the Technical Institute, which was near the School of Pedagogy, which was where Vietnam teachers studied. So we had interaction with student teachers that were from Vietnam as well as among ourselves. And we did that for 4 weeks. And we started, we'd try our language on people. The kids loved it. the adults didn't have much patience with us, but the kids loved it. And they'd laugh at our pronunciation and try to teach us how to say it right. And so the kids were great. Of course, they were all interested in us anyway, so... and we got to know, restaurants around there, even though there was a house across from the technical school where we ate. And I remember there was a great big jar of little white pills for stomach cramps and another large jar for diarrhea tablets. And that first month getting used to the food and getting used to everything was the most difficult, and we did dip into those two jars liberally. At the end of the school, we were supposed to be there 6 weeks, but in Vietnam, they did stuff without much notice. And they decided that the school year should start 2 weeks early. And so they canceled the last 2 weeks of our language training, so we only had 4 weeks. At the end of that 4 weeks, I was up to my neck in language study. And I was sort of at a point where I'd hit a wall. Where if I go to one more language training session, I'm just going to explode. Others, they wanted more. So we ended the language training and headed out to our assigned schools. And my school that I was assigned to had already started. It was because it was not on the same schedule as the regular schools, because it was an agriculture high school. So I was introduced about a couple of weeks after the school year had started. And I was assigned several classes. And I can remember the first time you get in front of that class, you know, you don't know enough Vietnamese to talk to them, and they don't know any English, and they're all looking at you, and now you get to put into practice what you have learned and how to teach language to people who don't speak your language and whose language you don't speak. And so, of course, you know, I was eager to start. It's something new, and I was really looking forward to it. And the students were shy at first, but they began to respond. They got the idea, and I had learned a few Vietnamese words like repeat and a few words like that that helped me through it, and I began teaching. School where I taught was on the top of a hill overlooking the airport. So every time a jet took off, I lost complete control of the class and had to, took me 10 minutes to get them back in order before I could start teaching again. Well, lo and behold, here in Kanta, where I was at the agriculture school, it was at the end of the runway. And if you know anything about military aircraft, like the C-130s and the C-136s, where they had, the C-136s had two engines and then two jet pods on the end of the wings to help them get off the ground. And they made a terrible noise. There was no quiet engines back in those days. So it would, the students didn't become disruptive as they had in Kansas City, but it was the fact that now I have to get them back on track, working on the English-speaking patterns that we were working on. So that always caused delays. But we worked through that, and I enjoyed teaching, and the students, they were very respectful. I had no discipline problems with any of them. And they all seemed, you know, they all seemed eager to learn, and I assumed that it was genuine. And I established very good student-teacher relations with the students. And I also established good teacher relations with the teachers. One thing we used to do is, they used to take, I was stationed with an agriculture worker by the name of Roger Hensey. He's now up living in Minnesota. And because he was in agriculture and I was teaching in an agriculture school, he became involved in my school because the students were working in agriculture. Mm-hmm. He worked mainly with the agriculture services, but he also involved himself with the school. Mm-hmm. So the teachers would take us out about every other month to some restaurant, and we'd order a big multi-course meal and eat and just have a fantastic time, laughing, and they were telling stories, and they were practicing their English on us, and we were practicing our Vietnamese on them, and it was a good social time. And Roger Hensey and I saved up our money so that every other month we could take the teachers out for a big meal in some restaurant. We'd switch around from this restaurant to that restaurant, and sometimes they'd have this deal at one of their homes, and so socially we became integrated, and basically we were having a great time.
What were the agricultural students supposed to get from learning the language that you were teaching?
The language of international trade all over the world is English. The agriculture texts, you know, the more advanced ones were in English. The Japanese who came to Vietnam to do business and to trade spoke English. And it was also in high school, you had a choice of taking one foreign language for 7 years and another foreign language for 4 years, a secondary language for 4 years. And the choices were English and French. And most of the students chose 7 years of English and 4 years of French. So it wasn't that they had never studied English, because they studied the grammar and everything. It was learning to pronounce, learning to speak it, and that's what we did.
So you were the only English teacher you were the only IVS teacher in that school. But you were housed with other IVS people.
Yeah,
Roger. To other things.
Well, Roger Hensley and I lived together, mm-hmm. and then there were some other teachers, Dan Vining and Suzanne Cracky and some others stayed in another house, which was our IVS Region 4 headquarters. The house that I stayed in was closer to my school, and it was actually closer to the agriculture ministry where Roger Hensley worked too, so that's why we stayed together in that house. So, you know, I could walk to school or I could ride my bike, depending on how muddy it was.
Well, thinking about and trying to keep it in perspective of this, thinking about your first experience. When you arrived there and you went out to the school, you were focused on, you know, getting started and doing the thing you'd come out to do. Did the politics or the war itself or any of those kind of issues have any impact on you then, those first few months?
The war had an impact in that just before I got to my station, a nearby village had been bombed. And that worried me. Been bombed by Americans. What worried me most about that was that innocent people had been killed. A lot of children, women, and old men. All the men had gone out to the fields to work. And because a spotter plane had taken some ground fire from that village, they called in the bombers. Well, I know the story very well because I married a girl who was in that village at the time of the bombing. But this was long before I ever met her.
No, yes.
That I was well aware of it, mm-hmm. and it worried me. It worried me especially when my students went out on field trips. It worried me so much that I would get a copy of the proposal for the field trip. I'd sit down with our interpreter, which you read in the letter, Mr. Chun. He would help me interpret it into English, and we would type it up. I would go to the senior province advisor, a man by the name of Colonel Wallace, and I would hand it to him and say, "We're going on a field trip with the students, and this is where we'll be." I did that for one specific reason. I did not want a spotter plane to go flying overhead, see a bunch of men, young men, gathered together in one place, and say, "There's VC soldiers down there," and call in an airstrike. Colonel Wallace interpreted my interest in telling him all about our activities as one of, "Here's a great American who's doing a wonderful job. and he's keeping us advised of his work. My perspective was, I don't want you bombing my students. And I never told him anything different. I let him think that the reason I was doing it was because I wanted him to know about what we were doing. Not that I didn't want him bombing my students.
In retrospect, do you think that even if he was on the same wavelength and actually cared, do you think that that would stop that event from happening? In retrospect, I mean, at the time, of course, you hoped that it would have.
You mean the bombing of the village? Yes. Well, under the circumstances, here's what happened. Two VC cadre had come into the village, gathered all the people together before they went out to their fields, and gave them some political indoctrination. After they were through with their indoctrination, everybody left to go to the fields, and the two Viet Cong cadre started walking out of the village on the path. As you know, villages are strung out along a canal. As they were walking, as they were leaving the village, the spotter plane comes overhead. They take their guns, and they take several pot shots at the plane. The spotter plane calls in. He's receiving ground fire. Colonel Wallace calls the Vietnamese and says, we're receiving ground fire from such and such a village. They say, we would like to do an airstrike. The Vietnamese command says, go ahead. And the Americans come and they bomb the village. The VC cadre are long gone. The only thing that are left are children swimming in the canal, jumping off of a bridge, the women, and the old men who are too old to go to the fields. And I know because the girl that I married was in the village, and she saw over 100 people get killed from the bombing. People that she knew.
How did the people respond to that? Or did she ever have any more recollection of that? She must have been old enough to know how people had to accept it, or...
It was a war. The people knew there was a war going on, and it was something that happened that... I don't want to say you get immune to it, but you get accustomed to it. They recognized it as a very bad thing to have happened. And when I brought her to America, we lived in an area where farmers fly airplanes. They're the same kind that the military used for spotter planes. She would get very nervous as planes were flying over. And I'd explain it to her, those are just farmers. They're not going to call in an airstrike.
So after you you became accustomed to the regional headquarters and teaching at the college, and how long did you do that?
3 years.
Just at in Cantu.
In Cantu, yes. Yeah. I had originally signed up for a 2-year tour, but I was enjoying what I was doing, so I signed up for an additional year.
And at the end of that 3 years, what did you feel like doing?
Well, I didn't want to leave, so I started looking for other employment. And Chase Manhattan Bank was hiring supervisors for their banking facilities that they had in country for the military. And when they saw my resume that I had a college education, they snapped at that and hired me.
And where were you? Where did you live when you worked for them?
I lived in Saigon for a year, and then I lived up in Quy Nhơn for a year.
And let's see, is there an after that? No, that's about it.
Yeah, that.
And how did you come to leave Vietnam?
Well, they were starting to pull troops out of Vietnam, so there was not the military presence, and they began shutting down banking facilities at various bases and consolidating facilities. And so the bank says, well, you know, your tour's done, we're ready to send you back. So began the paperwork to get my family out. And as soon as the paperwork came through, they flew me back to the States.
Did you continue working for Chase when you got back?
For 1 month I worked for them in New York to learn that New York City was not where I wanted to live or work. I thought I'd try it, but thank you, but no thank you. I left my family in Kansas with my folks. So I tried it for a month before thinking about bringing them out, and I said, well, that's it.
What did you do then?
Well, I stayed at home for a while, and then I moved to Denver and started looking for a job, only to find out that thousands of other returning Vietnam veterans were also looking for work. And rather than finding work, that we were in a recession and with high unemployment, and that it was really difficult to find anything to do. And I ended up working as an office manager for very low pay. Office manager, you could put that in quotes, because all I did was clerical work in an office of one. And then I started delivering the Denver Post to supplement that. And a new terminal manager came in, and he fired me. I think it was because I was trying to unionize the office. And, you know, the drivers were paid very well because they were in the Teamsters. Mm-hmm. But their clerical staff was paid next to nothing. And so I wanted to get the Teamsters to represent the office. There were now two of us in the office because the workload had increased. And I think they got wind of it and fired me. Mm-hmm. So then I went, that's when I started delivering the Denver Post. And I got a night job working in the airport for a restaurant as a maitre d'.
But you liked restaurants. So there was, I'm not thinking of this, a small joke. I worked in a restaurant myself, so I appreciate the work.
Yeah, in about an eight-month period, I became a supervisor, and I did that until I went to work for Frontier Airlines. Of course, I met the supervisors who worked for Frontier, and I'd invite them for free dinners, mm-hmm. because I could sign the ticket.
Right.
And they said, well, why don't you come work for Frontier? And so then I went to work for them. Of course, that was the end of the free meal ticket for them.
But they got a good employee.
Yeah, I think so. And I worked for them until the company went bankrupt and then went with United Airlines.
Did United buy up parts of Frontier, or did you?
They were supposed to buy the whole company, but the pilots torpedoed it.
How did you make the transition from Frontier to United? You just put in an application with United?
I heard that they were hiring Frontier people. I heard that on the news, on KNX radio. They said, United is hiring former Frontier employees. Boy, I beat it down to that office and put in my application. And it took them a month to process the application, and they called me and says, you can start work.
Great. What did you do? What do you do for United now?
Ramp service, which is anything from cargo to baggage handling to fueling. What I'm doing now is I'm fueling aircraft.
So you never went back to, never carried education back with you from Vietnam into a career?
Because I would have had to go back to school. Mm-hmm. And when I came back here, I had a family.
Right.
I already had two kids, mm-hmm. and a wife. And I couldn't take time off to go back to school. If I'd have come straight back and gone to Kansas City, mm-hmm. they had a job for me.
Right.
Because I had been in the service, they would have been required to hire me back. But because I stayed an extra 2 years in Vietnam, and because I had no family in Kansas City, and I felt I really needed some help, I went to Denver, where I had a brother and sister living at the time. And the kind of help that I needed to reestablish myself, because, you know, here I've been out of the country for 5 years. A lot of things have happened and a lot of changes have taken place. And it's like walking into a new world. I didn't have culture shock going to Vietnam. I had culture shock coming back to the United States. Because we had been told and we were expecting, we knew what to expect when we got to Vietnam. And we were wide-eyed and adventurous and willing to experiment and taste something new. But when you come back to a country that you have been out of for 5 years, so much has changed that you're not ready for it.
What kind of what changes had happened that you felt least ready for?
The employment situation had changed. For example, in the teaching field, there was a shortage of teachers when I left. I had my choice. Everywhere I put in my application, they wanted me. Mm-hmm. When I came back, now there are waiting lists to get into teaching. I had thought that the employment situation when I had left was a very easy one. Mm-hmm. When I came back, I found it very, very tough. Technologically speaking, there had been a lot of changes. Prices had changed, expenses, you know, it was more expensive to live. There had been a lot of cultural change in the United States.
What do you call a cultural change that had happened while you were there?
Political climate, moral climate. I didn't see it so much in Kansas where I grew up, because that was a very stable environment. But going to the larger cities, things had changed a lot.
So what year did you come back? Did you come back in 69?
I came back in 71.
That's what I was going to say. It must have been... I mean, we were into disco. Those were major changes in America.
Yeah.
Even I noticed that. No, I'm kidding. That's I actually left the country, then didn't come back. I missed the entire disco era. I was gone for 5 years also. So.
Well, I find people referring to something and I'm saying, oh?
Right.
What happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, because American culture became so video-oriented after that, I was able to actually eventually catch reruns of all the things, everything that happened between basically 1970 and 1976, and I got caught up on it.
Well, one of the things that had come in was miniskirts.
Uh-huh.
I was used to women wearing dresses below their knees, and you come back and those skirts were hardly still on the thigh, you know.
And in fact, they'd had hot pants by then.
Yeah.
Yes, which was even culture shock for me, just going to see people in Chicago who had them. They weren't that popular where I was living, but yes, I can identify with that. So you went to Vietnam in July of 66, and you served 3 years with IVS, which would be until approximately 1969.
Well, yeah.
And then from 69 to 71, you were working for the bank.
Right.
Now, let's just run backwards here, back to the IVS years, and try to run through some things that were in Vietnam. In 66, 67, and 68, those were years of extremely heavy combat in many parts of Vietnam, but more in the Central Highlands than around where you were stationed. But did you sense an increasing tempo to the events around you?
when I arrived in Vietnam, to hear a gun was an unusual occurrence. Once in a while, in the dead of night, you'd hear a kaboom, a howitzer firing. And you'd say, well, there must be some action somewhere. And you may hear several of them. But and security was always on our minds. Before we ever went anywhere, we checked at the TOC to find out whether the roads where we were going were secure. The agriculture teachers, whenever we went out somewhere, they would stop at the TOC.
The Tactical Operations Center?
Yes. Yeah. And they would check to see, make sure that the area where we were going to was secure. And that was always on everybody's mind. That was a high priority. But never saw any action. Never heard anything except an occasional boom. And then they decided to start bringing troops. One thing that happened, there was an air base about 7 clicks north, that's kilometers, 7 clicks north of the city of Cần Thơ, that the Viet Cong had promised to mortar once a month. And the Viet Cong were very faithful. So you could hear that. Mm-hmm. And according to military personnel who were staying on that base, if it was the 29th of the month and nothing had happened, they were very nervous because they knew that they were going to get hit that night or the next night or the next night. You know, like clockwork, they were going to get it. That was the major, that was about the only action you heard about. Then they started bringing in, at that time all they had was military advisors down in the Delta. That was it. And they were very low profile. You saw very few of them. You didn't see, they were not high profile. They had a little compound where they were on that we used to go to get a hamburger. Just to remember, about once a week we would go and get a hamburger just to remember what a hamburger tasted like. Or a hot dog, something like that. And they had a PX there. We got $15 a month, and we'd go look around, see what there was, and walk out. Maybe buy some soap or some razor blades or something like that. You know, stuff that we couldn't get on the local market. But then they started bringing in troops, and then the war started. Until then, very little activity. As soon as the American troops started arriving, Viet Cong troops and North Vietnamese started moving in to counter it, to counterbalance it. And then, you know, the war was a nightly event. Like, now you go home and you turn on the 6 o'clock news.
Right.
We'd go up at dusk, up on the roof, and watch the war. Because it was all around us. And I knew that some of those events were on the evening news. And when some big events happened near us, that my parents would hear it. And I wrote them a letter. I wrote them a letter saying, yeah, this happened, but it didn't affect us. It wasn't close to us. And I explained to them, even if it's a mile away, it's like being 100 miles away. Because these events, these battles or whatever it is, don't really get into where we are because we're in a secured area. And then terrorist activity started happening in the city. And then I had to sort of change the tone of my letters a little bit, say, you probably heard about this and this happening and this is what happened, saying, but the people in the house weren't injured, nothing happened, you know, to keep my folks from worrying about it, except it happened to us. My
my brother was reading the letters, and he says he's talking about himself.
Were there incidents of which, grenades were rolled into restaurants or under vehicles?
We had mines go off under our vehicles while we were sitting at the house, at the headquarters, at our regional headquarters, waiting for Ted Kennedy to come over. He was there checking out the refugee problem, and he was going to come over and talk to Dave Gittleson, who was killed a few weeks later. And we were sitting there in the living room waiting. And he was supposed to get there about 7 o'clock when the first mine went off. And we were sitting in the living room, and the door, we had double glass doors, stained glass doors. One side was open. The other side was closed. And it's like just a little bit to my left here. Mm-hmm. When the first one went off. And we sat there, we were stunned. We were playing Yahtzee. Our interpreter and some of the other guys, we were sitting there playing Yahtzee while we were waiting for Ted Kennedy to get there. And he was running a little late. The first mine went off. And we didn't know what it was. You know, we heard this tremendous explosion. Mm-hmm. And we saw dust billowing up. We heard something hit back behind us. There was an opening into a dining area. And there was a bookcase there. And we looked, and there was ball bearings embedded in the bookcase on the back wall. That had come through the open door, didn't touch the closed portion. Mm-hmm. If it would have, it would have just shattered the glass. Just came through that open portion and hit that wall. If anybody had been standing there, they'd have been seriously injured or killed. And then we sort of looked out. We didn't see anybody there or anything. And we started looking around. We saw the ball bearings embedded in the wall and dust rising up. We finally figured out that a mine had been set out under another,